Maine's forest economy today and in the future. Maine's forests are an astonishing resource. The Maine Forest Products Council estimates that Maine's forest land contains more than 24 billion live trees, at least an inch in diameter. That's 24 billion. Like many industries in Maine, it is facing challenges. One of the biggest, many trained loggers are approaching retirement age. In recent years, community colleges and industry groups have come together to boost training programs. They've also worked to diversify Maine's forest products economy and use technology to its best advantage. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we are coming to you live from Presque Isle to talk about Maine's vast forest, the economy it supports, and what it will look like in the future. What are your hopes for Maine's forests and the communities they support? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the University of Maine Presque Isle campus, I'm Jennifer Rooks. And this is Maine Calling. It's no surprise, especially to the people in this room, that Maine's forest economy is incredibly important, both to this region and to the overall Maine economy. But forestry is and has been a changing industry. It faces natural challenges from pests and wildfire to man-made challenges, including regulations and competition between use for conservation and recreation. Today, we are going to discuss how the forest economy is positioning itself for the future. With me today, Doug Sear. He is Human Resource Manager with Irving Woodlands, LLC, and Irving Forest Products, Incorporated. Jeff Dubas is an instructor of forestry at the University of Maine, Fort Kent. And Ryan Wishart. Did I pronounce that right?
That is correct.
Is operations manager for Seven Islands Land Company. As always, we want to hear from you. How important is the role of forestry to your life? What do you want to know about forestry in Maine? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. And for those of you online, you can watch this broadcast live on our Facebook page. We're also welcoming members of the audience here today at the University of Maine Presque Isle to ask questions. So, Doug, I'll start with you. What makes Maine forests so special?
Well, it is the bread and butter of our, I'll say, the county as well as the state. You know, it drives the economics of a lot. And if you consider what it does here for the county, whether it's people out logging or if it's some of the other infrastructures like sawmills and paper mills and pulp mills right across, It really is what keeps this place going.
All right. I've read that over 90% of Maine's land is forested. Is there any other state that even approaches that?
I'm not sure about other states, but I know we're heavily forested. But it comes with, you know, the ideas and notions of sustainable forestry. We spend a lot of time and effort making sure we're doing the right things. Just recently, we were awarded with an SFI award. So basically, that's a sustainable forestry initiative. So it's really doing the right things for the land. But also, one of the things that brought me back home, which is up here in the county, was a place for my kids to grow. So that's really what it's about.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, tomorrow we're doing our program on potatoes, and I think a lot of people in the rest of Maine think of Aroostook County and they think of potatoes, but, boy, there are a lot of trees up here, too. Ryan, what kind of trees do we have in Maine? What are some of the varieties? We were talking beforehand, and you said there really are a lot of varieties.
There are a lot of species of trees in Maine. We put it in a few different general categories. We have softwoods and hardwoods. Some of your common softwoods would be spruce and fir, which you see a lot at Lowe's and Home Depot for your dimension lumber for building houses. And then hardwood tends to be a lot of lumber and floors, furniture, cabinetry. That's where that stuff is. But there's many species. I think there's somewhere around 65 different tree species in Maine.
Want to bring Jeff, you into the conversation. Let's talk about Maine's overall forest economy. It was interesting to me to learn that you mentioned, Ryan, the spruce and fir, that spruce and fir isn't as valuable as it was 15 or 20 years. What kind of changes are you seeing in the industry that maybe people on the outside wouldn't be aware of?
I think the biggest change really has been the loss of the spruce fir pulp market. You know, that was the driving force in the industry for well over a century. And, you know, that was the bread and butter of the products here. And now all of a sudden, very quickly, because of changes in technology and where the paper's coming from, that market's basically gone. So the whole industry has had to evolve around that. And what are you going to be doing now with this product that doesn't exist? What are you going to be doing with those trees that no longer make spruce fir pulp?
And when you say spruce fir pulp, you mean pulp that will eventually become paper.
Right, right. In that market, because look at how do we read the newspaper now? We read it on our phone or on our tablet. How do we receive notifications from anybody? It's via email. Everything now is electronic, so there isn't the need for those types of paper anymore that we used to have. And then you have foreign competition that can, you know, produce the paper cheaper and dump it into this country. So those two things have really hurt the industry.
Somebody might be watching the news and reading about the closure of mills and thinking, is Maine's forest products industry doomed? Is it doomed, Doug? Is this an industry that's not going to be around, or is it going to be around and just completely different?
I think, like Jeff said, the biggest thing is we get to understand what we do with our products. So you take the softwood pulp, we get to find other alternatives to using that material because the material is still there, whether you want it or not, and it still has value. So it's coming up with new ways. It's working with the universities, University of Maine Orno, University of Maine Fort Kent, or even the technology side of the world with the Northern Maine Community Colleges, coming up with better ways or new ways to use that fiber.
What kind of things is Irving, the trees that you harvest, where are they going? What are they being made into?
Yeah, so we're the dimensional side on one aspect. We got 10 sawmills in the company, ranging from cedar to hardwood to spruce fir. Now, the dimensional stuff, they go to general consumers like you and I. So, and that's a big part of our business. So a lot of it is just homeowners.
All right. And Ryan, Doug earlier mentioned sustainable forestry. Can you explain what that means? Does that just mean growing more trees than you take down, or is it something more than that?
Well, you can put a metric to it. I mean, sustainable in one way is basically, are we harvesting more wood fiber than we're growing? And you could see how that'd be an issue if you were harvesting more than you're growing. So we're always striving to make sure that we're managing the forest in a way that we can continuously harvest these volumes, and we're growing them at the same time. And we're consistently trying to move that forest into a better health, you know, looking at those things. And then, you know, there's other social and economic factors that are in there. But the company that I work for, Seven Islands, was a leader in third-party certification, looking at those types of things. We are...
What does that mean? What is a third party certifying? What are they looking at?
So a third party comes in and looks at our forest practices and deems them as sustainable if you're working under the SFI program. Or another one that's very popular is FSC, which is the Forest Stewardship Council. And they as well look at all the different facets of the forest industry and make sure that what you're doing is sound for the environment, sound for, you know, the social aspects. And it's a global initiative, and we've been part of it for a very long time.
Jeff, who's the biggest competition?
For forest products in general?
And for Maine, for Maine's forest products. Is it like so many other products, China?
It can be. In the case of... paper products, you know, for sure, and places like Brazil, anywhere they can produce the product cheaper than us. Canada can also be a competitor because they produce a lot of dimensional lumber, softwood lumber. So that's coming into this country, and right now, you know, there's a whole discussion on the Canadian tariffs and whatnot. So that can provide some competition to us as well. So we're getting it, you know, locally and internationally, and even just down south. You know, they can produce a lot of these same types of products we do, dimensional lumber and whatnot. We have to compete within the country as well.
I understand that forestry is like so many other industries in Maine, in which the people who are working there, looking at you three, I wouldn't believe it, are aging out of the industry, and you're looking at a labor shortage. Is that accurate? And what's being done to address that?
Yeah, I'd say that there is a labor shortage. You know, one of the biggest challenges that I face as HR is finding people, qualified people, skilled people to run our operations, whether that's in the woods or that's in the sawmill, because they're all technical jobs. Nowadays, it's not like it was 20, 30, I'll even say 10 years ago, where you didn't need a special skill and you could get in and do most of your stuff through apprenticeship or on the job. Nowadays, you need the technical PLC type training. You need the, if you've seen any of the wood harvesting pieces of gear today, it's like running a space shuttle. It's very technical, and so you need that special skill set. So not only that, but you take into consideration the outmigration of young people going to the Bangors of Portland and then the kids from Portland going to Boston. It really has a huge impact on this area. So,
all right, Ryan, give us the sell. If I'm a young person, I'm trying to decide what to do with my life, why do I want to go into the woods?
Well, one great thing about being in the woods is your office is the woods. I mean, you mentioned the drive from Fort Kent down to Presque Isle. That's one of the best things about my job is when I'm going from harvest operation to harvest operation and I'm riding around, I'm like, somebody's paying me to ride around in some of the most beautiful areas of the state. And there is a lot of positive outlook. Of course, we've been weathering a pretty difficult storm lately, but there's always opportunities at times like this and new technology and different ways of thinking will change the industry and make it very interesting for younger guys like us.
Jeff, you teach. Who are your students? Where do they come from?
When I originally came here, most of my students were from the county and a lot of them right from the Fort Kent area, like Ryan was one of my students. But in recent years, it seems like we're starting to get more students from throughout the state. If I look at my current freshman class, they're from all over. I think I only have one that's actually from the county. And we are pulling in an occasional student from out of state. So they're primarily Maine students, usually right out of high school.
All right. And I know we have a few here in the audience today, and I'm really hoping that some students will come to the microphone later on the program and talk about what is exciting to them about the industry. I want to ask you all about the threats to the industry. And I understand one is the spruce budworm. I'm not going to characterize what it is. I'll let one of you explain to me why it's so scary. And folks who are old enough remember the 70s and 80s when it was really a problem. So who wants to tell us what's going on today?
I'm by no means the expert on spruce budworm, but I have seen some of the devastation that it has, not only from the 70s and 80s from photos then, but just if you would just go across the border here about 80 miles north to Quebec or even northern parts of New Brunswick, you could see some of the devastation that spruce budworm has on the forest. So, which brings other issues, from fires that it'll eventually get to. And so it's really some of the remedy or some of the preemptive stuff that we're trying to be proactive on here in Maine.
And you say it's right at our doorstep in Quebec and New Brunswick right now. Our neighbors are already trying to deal with it. What's going on there that is helpful, and what are the worries?
I guess I'll answer. So as far as New Brunswick, they're working with the government to try to get funding to whether it's spray programs or if it's different harvesting techniques or what have you. But the biggest challenge that they're facing is really time. Time of when the next outbreak is going to happen. I mean, it's some of the footage that they've since released not too long ago, back in July, of these outbreaks. If you look at the radars of weather, it was basically, it looked like there was a snowstorm coming through, but that was a bunch of moths that were popping up on radar. So that's the scary thing in my eyes. So if you think about the economics of what that timber has on the economies that it feeds, we'd be foolish not to be looking at it and figuring out ways to combat it.
Well, this is Maine Calling. We are on the road in Presque Isle, Maine. We're at the University of Maine at Presque Isle, and we're discussing Maine's forest economy. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. Jeff, folks who are old enough will remember the 1996 clear-cutting referendum and the compromise that grew out of that. Really hasn't surfaced as a huge statewide news story since then. What was the impact of that debate, that decision, the laws that came out of that? Has it had much of an impact in the last two decades?
Well, first of all, I wasn't in Maine at that time, but I do remember it quite clearly, and it definitely did bring clear-cutting to the forefront in the state. Since then, if you're looking at the numbers of acres that are being clear-cut here in Maine, it has been dropping through the years. So I don't think it's as much of an issue to people as what it used to be, so it's a little bit more off the radar screen. Now, just because we're clear-cutting less, does it mean we're doing better forestry? Absolutely not. I think that the important thing about the referendum is that we do still have clear-cutting as a tool that we can really use in sustainable forestry if it's done right. You know, I'm not, you know, advocating for wide-scale clear-cutting, but clear-cutting does have a definite need, a limited need here in forestry, and one that we need to maintain to use into the future. And hopefully, you know, in recent decades, with the decline in clear-cutting, it's being used more for the tool that it should be, rather than if we want to go back to the previous budworm era. And I think that's when clear-cutting really got its bad name, is, you know, we had wide-scale clear-cutting for salvage operations. And then in a lot of cases, that just continued after the budworm salvage. Whereas now, it seems like the clear-cut is more used in cases where it needs to be done because of the quality of trees or the type of timber. I'll use Irving, for instance. Doug, what is it, about 5,000 acres a year that you plant?
Yeah, it's very little compared to our overall production.
And I, you know, I think that's pretty standard across the industry. Those companies that are practicing sustainable forestry are only clear-cutting where it absolutely needs to. In the case of Irving, everything is replanted, or almost everything is replanted. So I don't think the issue is as strong as what it once was.
Has the industry itself, Ryan, changed? I mean, you were probably a kid when this debate was happening, right?
I was. I remember that going on, and I was only 11 years old at the time. But so the budworm to me is something that's maybe not as scary as some of the older colleagues that I work with, because they saw firsthand the devastation that happened. I have seen some of the footage that Doug is mentioning across the border in New Brunswick and Quebec. But our forest is different. So it's going to be interesting to see how that works. Back then we had a lot more mature fir, you know, which fir is the favorite food of the spruce budworm. And as they grow and increase in population, of course they need food to support that population. So that food to them is the most palatable. But our forest now is a lot more younger, you know, compared to what it was at that time. It's more vigorous. So that should help with some of those things. But it is actually pretty alarming when you see the big moth flights and how many moths there are, because there's just so many of them feeding on everything. And of course, at that time, I don't think it matters whether it's a small tree or a big tree, but we'll see more in the future.
All right. Well, we are going to take a quick break. Before we do, a word about our upcoming programs. Tomorrow, we're going to be back here discussing potato farming in the state. We're also hosting a luncheon here tomorrow that you are invited to. You can visit our website or Facebook page for more information and to RSVP to the luncheon. When we come back, your comments and questions about forestry and the forest products industry. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the Kennebec Company, displaying their Maine-crafted period kitchens and cabinetry at their showroom in downtown Bath, kennebeccompany.com, and CEI, proud to support Aroostook County and all of Maine with financing, business advising, and industry expertise. Learn more at CEI.org. Maine Public Classical is now heard on 5 FM frequencies around Maine, in Portland, Bangor, Waterville, the Fryeburg-Bridgeton area, and the Millbridge-MDI area. And coming soon, sometime this fall, is a new station originating in the Booth Bay Harbor-Damariscotta area. It's a strong signal that will reach from Brunswick to Thomaston and as far inland as Augusta. We're excited about this new addition to Maine Public Classical, and we'll keep you posted when we know when it will be up and running. Maine Public Classical, how to find and listen to it. You can find that information online at mainepublic.org. Tonight at 9 on Maine Public Television, the 10-week rebroadcast of Ken Burns' documentary The Vietnam War continues with Episode 4, Defying American Air Power. North Vietnamese troops and materiel stream down the Ho Chi Minh Trail while Saigon struggles to pacify the countryside. As an anti-war movement builds at home, GIs discover that this war is nothing like their father's war. The Vietnam War, the fourth of 10 episodes, tonight at 9 on Maine Public Television. And if you're not able to watch on TV tonight, all 10 episodes are available on Passport until the end of the year.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and we are broadcasting today from the Presque Isle UMaine campus. Today on the program, The Role of Forestry in Maine. With me, Jeff Dubas, an instructor of forestry at the University of Maine, Fort Kent. Doug Sear is a human resource manager with Irving Woodlands, LLC, and Irving Forest Products, Incorporated. And Ryan Wishart is operations manager for Seven Islands Land Company. We invite you to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. If you're online, you can watch us on Facebook Live from the Maine Calling Facebook page. And we welcome folks here in the audience today to ask questions at the microphone that our engineers have set up. I'm going to start with a call from Cliff in Parsonsfield. Hi, Cliff. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Thanks, Jennifer, for inviting me on.
Great, Cliff. Are you on a speakerphone by chance?
Yes. Should I just regular phone?
Yes, please. Are you there? Oh, hopefully Cliff can call back. That's shoot. We'll go to Christy on Facebook. How does the replanting process work? What specific trees grow best for replanting? How long does it take them to mature? As a landowner, what can I do to keep the tree population healthy?
Well, I can tell you what we do and what we do. So basically, the tree species are a variety of species of softwood trees that we plant. So company-wide, we plant in our nurseries about 22 to 25 million trees every spring and then transplant it on some of our land base. So here in Maine, this year, we would have planted 3.2 million. So as far as what species where, really it depends on soil types, type of terrain, stuff like that, on what you would plant where you want to plant. So if you're talking your general yard, there's preparation, there's site prep. You know, for us, it's big skidders and forders with trenchers on it. But for the homeowner, it would be, you know, prepping your land appropriately for whatever species.
And can someone turn to UMaine Cooperative Extension for help with, or is there somewhere else to turn for learning about your soil and what might be right for your land?
At University of Maine, the Cooperative Extension would be able to handle some of those questions for the landowner.
All right, great. We'll go to Karen, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Karen. Go ahead. Karen, hello. Go ahead.
Hi. Sorry about that. I was on mute. I do have a question for you gentlemen. This past summer, I attended the Appalachian Trail Conference that was held in Colby College. And I thought I was attending a U.S. forestry workshop, but it was actually a forestry person that worked for the Weyerhaeuser Corporation that I believe owns the largest amount of Maine forest private stock. And I have a question regarding what do you think of sustainable foresting when this private corporation has said that they use glyphosate, which is basically Roundup, to spray specific tracts of forest to kill the hardwoods so that it is easier to harvest the softwoods. Is this really sustainable foresting?
Okay, and let's start by asking if that's a typical practice. Is that something that's used often?
It is a common practice in the forest industry. I guess, you know, we didn't really get into the depths of silviculture. I'll throw in a little plug here that what we're trying to do in the forest is mimic natural processes and manage that forest to its best health. Of course, there's different types of succession. Hardwood trees are usually earlier in the succession of a forest. Softwoods will come later due to whether or not they're shade tolerant or, you know, if they need a lot of light. So softwood is a real important part of our mix to harvest in the forest. And in some of these areas, if you would not intervene with glyphosate, the forest would actually come back to more hardwood, which the composition wasn't really that way to begin with. So we try to do as much as we can in a forest practices sense to naturally get back those desirable species. But once in a while, we need to step in and intervene with glyphosate. So it's not necessarily that, you're killing all these trees. It's that you're helping all these other ones that are a little bit at a disadvantage under those certain conditions.
One thing I want to mention is that since the last budworm outbreak, the species composition of Maine's forests has changed quite a bit. We've lost a lot of the softwood component, and that's basically because of the heavy harvesting that went on during the last budworm with no follow-up treatments. If we were to continue that practice, we would find more and more hardwoods and less softwoods, whereas with the use of glyphosate and other similar tools, that enables us to control that hardwood growth and to focus on bringing back some of this softwood forest that we've lost. In the case, if you're, say, you're planting trees here in Maine, it's one of the things we're both blessed and cursed with here in Maine is too much regeneration. A lot of places in the country, it's very hard to grow trees. Here, it's very easy to grow trees, but you can't always grow what you want. So if you're, let's say you're trying to grow softwoods, if you're planting softwoods, the hardwoods are going to come in very strong and compete with those trees. And after you've made that investment in planting, you can lose that investment because the hardwoods will simply take over and choke out your softwoods. So using chemicals like glyphosate enable us to maintain that softwood. Another issue we have here in Maine, and I know Ryan's company deals with this a lot, is beech. American beech is an important species here in Maine historically, more for wildlife than for timber because of its mast for bear and deer and other wildlife. But the problem is we've been hit with the beech bark disease, which has devastated the beech population. And this was a disease brought in from overseas and has pretty much killed off the beech. But what we get is this. Every time a beech tree dies, you get 200 sprouts back, and all these sprouts just completely compete with everything else, sugar maple, yellow birch, and the softwood. And so that's another way to keep this population of beech down so we can actually grow something that's going to amount to something, because now beech lives about 20 years and dies and then just creates new sprouts, and the process just starts over and over. So it's getting harder to grow what we want in the forest. So glyphosate is just something that we can use to help better our management.
Karen, thanks so much for your question. Do we have any questions from the audience? Go ahead.
Hello there. Thanks for doing the show. This is a great topic. My name's Harrison Kilpatrick. I live in Limestone. I do forestry consulting in the area with my father, and I'm operating as an unlicensed forester. After 4 years of this and about 80 hours of education, I'll be eligible for my forestry license, and this is a little-known program that I think might be worth mentioning for people who are interested in forestry. My question is about Maine tree growth tax law. This program provides property tax incentives for landowners to cut their timber. In Aroostook County, tree growth valuations are about a third of real land valuations. So that's about $160 an acre versus the $500 an acre. So how do your companies utilize tree growth? Do you have any problems with it, or is there anything you'd like to see done to change it? And can we find something to do with tamarack? Thank you.
And I want you all to explain why the very last part of his question got a laugh from the audience.
Because, again, going back to markets for tamarack. But as far as the tree growth, yes, we are utilizing the tree growth tax for our company. And it's basically the way it was set up. So,
yeah, most forest landowners take advantage of the tree growth tax law. It is something that's not as well known to maybe some of the smaller forest landowners, but as licensed foresters, we usually try to work with the public and tell them about those opportunities. There are some great opportunities there, so I would recommend for everybody to research that if you own a large amount of forest land. The tamarack joke is because it goes back to the whole softwood pulp situation. We can sell tamarack or American larch as a pulpwood product, But other than that, there's very small niche markets for lumber.
All right. And, you know, the panel here today is not representative of small woodlot owners, but my understanding, and maybe, Jeff, you can talk to this, is many of the small woodlot owners specialize in the very hardwoods we were just discussing, and that their products are different. Can you just give us a brief explanation of where that kind of wood will go?
Well, I wouldn't always say that the products are different. It's the scale of the product that's different, the amount of volume that they're producing. And in the case of the small woodlot owner, they can maybe focus on bringing that product to an even higher quality than, say, a landowner that owns a 500,000 or 1 million acres, such things as pruning and crop tree release, things that are going to enable individual trees to grow at a much faster rate. Rather than managing at the landscape scale, you can manage down to the single tree, because a small landowner is not overwhelmed with, you know, hundreds of thousands of acres. So they have the ability to work in that regard. It becomes a little different when it's time to harvest, too, because they don't necessarily have large volumes that are going to require huge equipment and big crews to move in. So they're probably going to be more apt to work with some of those smaller loggers, maybe that, you know, person on the cable skidder with the chainsaw that, you know, somebody within Irving or Seven Islands, you know, wouldn't be able to hire, whereas a small landowner can. So they've got it's not so much the trees that they're growing is different, but maybe the way they're growing them might be a little bit more difference, with a little bit more emphasis on the individual tree and really bringing that tree to the highest quality, because you can really nurture it for a longer period of time.
All right. Do we have another question from the audience? Introduce yourself, please.
Oh. Hi, my name is Kenneth Thompson. I was just curious as to how does one get into the business of forestry? Like, what degrees would you need?
So I guess from an HR perspective, you know, it's a wide variety of degrees. You know, if I take, for instance, our company, if I were to look just in Woodlands alone, we probably have 15, 20 different degrees. Now, if you look in forestry alone, I mean, we have foresters probably in every role, from process improvement to foresters on the ground to planning and layout. So it really depends on the individual and what they do, because it's not just the old forester going in and just being a logger. Now it's like we mentioned earlier, it's very technical. So it's you asked a pretty loaded question, I guess.
All right. Well, good luck to you. I'll go to a Facebook post here. This is from Kristen on Facebook. We have sustainable forests and millions invested. What does the forest industry need in Aroostook County to remain sustainable? Infrastructure, funding, workers, or something else?
Yes.
Yeah, all the above. No, it's a great question. And going back to markets and mentioning silviculture again, what people don't understand is we get tied into talking about products and we just think that these are products that we find on the land base. But what we're trying to do as foresters is manage that timber and manage that forest. So that relies on a whole basket of products that you're removing, you know, pulpwood stems that are lower quality to try to get better quality trees on your land, but you need a market for it, because if you can at least cover the cost of the silviculture, it's not a real big investment that you have to wait longer. And sometimes if you don't have a pulp market, you can't actually get a return on your forest land investment. So those things are very important. So markets are very important. Labor, of course, the more skilled and more educated people you have that are helping you out to figure out these types of things will help the business. And transportation, we've seen great improvements. You know, I look at Route 11 and think about traveling up and down Route 11. The state has done a great job of investing in our infrastructure, even up here in the county. I'm sure that it's that way all over the state. But there's probably opportunities there where, you know, I know there was a pilot project on 95 where we just bumped the weights up from 80,000 to 100,000 pounds here in the state, part of another little project, I think, with Vermont and New Hampshire. But stuff like that, like in Canada, if they add an extra axle to a tractor-trailer truck, they have more stopping power, so then they're allowed to put a little bit more weight on. So now you're doing more work with that same person, and it's all about efficiencies. We're competing globally, and it seems interesting to say that when you're up here in Aroostook County, which you feel like you're maybe at the end of the world at times, but we're very much part of the global economy. So every small improvement we can make on those types of things can help us remain in the hunt.
All right. Well, we do have to take another quick break, and a word about tomorrow's show. We're going to be right back here at University of Maine Presque Isle talking about the role of potatoes in the Maine economy. If you want to submit a question ahead of time, we'd love that. You can email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. And if you're in the area, come by. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Audubon, a community of people who understand that when Maine's wildlife thrives, Maine thrives. Learn more at maineaudubon.org. MMG Insurance in Presque Isle, protecting your piece of the world, proud to support Maine Calling live from the county, mmgins.com. And Cary Medical Center, committed to delivering the highest quality healthcare in a compassionate and nurturing environment in Aroostook County. CaryMedicalCenter.org.
NFL players are still kneeling during the national anthem. President Trump wants them suspended.
It is very disrespectful to our country when they take a knee during our national anthem.
But not everyone knows that kneeling during the anthem was partly the idea of a former Green Beret. And he has written an open letter to every single American. Nate Boyer this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening. And join us at 2 o'clock following Maine Calling for World Affairs. Today, a panel discussion on trust, justice, and the conflict continuum. World Affairs coming up after Maine Calling here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling, broadcasting from the campus of UMaine Presque Isle. Today on the program, the role of forestry in Maine and in this part of Maine. Joining me today, Ryan Wishart, operations manager with Seven Islands Land Company. Jeff Dubas, an instructor of forestry at the University of Maine. And Doug University of Maine Fort Kent, excuse me, and Doug Sear, Human Resource Manager for Irving Woodlands LLC and Irving Forest Products Incorporated. If you'd like to join our conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Before we go back to calls and emails, though, I want to follow up on something we were talking about before. I had asked each of you what the products are now in Maine, especially now that we've seen so many pulp and paper mills close. But let's talk a little bit, Ryan, about secondary products and residuals. What is a residual?
So a residual, like in our manufacturing process, or sawmilling, you have sawdust, bark, different products that we call them that are a residual from that process. And of course, lumber is worth money, and that's why we sell, you know, the round wood to these mills, and they manufacture it into these products for end users. But these residuals are becoming a problem with current day markets. Normally we sell them as biomass to energy facilities where they produce electricity, steam, and there's not a lot of money in that, but at least it pays to take care of the waste. Well, if we lose those markets here in Maine, all of a sudden now you need to do something with that waste. So it costs money. And where we're competing on a global level, margins are so tight that something like that can actually put us over the tipping point of not being able to compete anymore.
Are we at risk of losing those? Are biomass plants closing? Or are there not enough?
Well, there was a bill earlier in the year for the legislature. They stepped in and helped out with the contracts with some of the energy producing facilities here in the state. Re-Energy is one of those companies. So there's a whole other interesting set of scenarios that goes on with what they call renewable energy credits and how the electricity markets work, which I would encourage people to read up on. But typically here in Maine, we have benefited from the rec credits from places like Massachusetts and Connecticut, because they actually pay a credit for that type of electricity because it's considered green. But those are starting to run out, and we're looking at a situation where that type of electricity, when it's generated, can't compete with some of the other cheaper lines of electricity. So if we lose those markets, we're looking at some issues with our mills and what will we do there.
Isn't there, Jeff, some research going on? I know, you mean Orono has the composites lab. Aren't there isn't there some creative thinking going on about what we might do with things like sawdust?
Yeah, there is, and that work is primarily being done at Orono with, composites. There's been biofuel, a lot of research done on biofuels, converting wood into a fuel that can be burned, especially high-quality fuels that can be burned, and, it'd be almost a byproduct of the pulping industry. There is a lot of work going on in those fields, and, there's ideas probably coming down the pipeline that we don't even know about now that in the future could be a major source for our industry here in Maine that are just, being studied now. So things are always changing, and that's what we can really hope for, is that as we lose some markets, maybe we can make those up with other markets of maybe even higher value products than what we have now.
Mm-hmm. Doug, is there any particular product or area that you think is a lot of promise?
A lot of promise. Keep buying 2x4s and toilet paper, and there's a lot of promise. No, but the only other thing I'd add to Jeff is, the whole nanotechnology, nanocellulose, which, I'm by no means an expert, but it's another area that the universities are trying to investigate and understand. Is there technologies out there that we haven't grasped or put our hands on that could be helping what Ryan's talking about? And can we use these byproducts, these residuals from our plants, to use in these processes? And that could be the saving grace, maybe.
All right. Well, I'm going to go back to Cliff, who we lost earlier in the program. Cliff, thanks for calling back, and go ahead.
Thanks, Jennifer, and thanks to all your guests there. The reason why I love Maine so much is because it is one of the most forested states in the lower 48. I came here back around 1970 as a young fellow, one of those young people out of college that didn't go to the city, but went to the country. And the reason why I went to the country is because of the beauty here in the state of Maine. Now, sustainability and beauty seem to have gone hand in hand, at least in the most recent history of the state, in terms of forestry. We're still the most forested state because of some of the practices, I think, that loggers have put into effect over the last probably 100 years. Prior to that, I believe the state was getting pretty thin in most places. So a part of the economy of Maine is the fact that we have so much beautiful forested land. And Maine has always traditionally been an ecological, nature-based economy. Now, when I say nature-based, it's not only for logging.
Cliff, do you have a question? Do you have a question for the panel?
My question is why isn't forestry thinking about not only taking the resources and turning them into money, but seeing the existing resource as an economical means for the state?
Okay. Is your question,
finish this. I came here and I started a nature-based business that I have successfully ran for 26 years. Without cutting any trees, I work with forestry and other landowners, and I lead a mountain biking adventure center.
So Cliff, is your question whether there needs to be renewed partnerships or more working together between the recreation industry and the forestry industry?
Yes, I believe there needs to be that, but we still need to hold on to those practices that have kept Maine, a forested state.
Okay. Thank you.
So I guess I'll weigh in on that. Seven Islands was one of the early managers in the state. And when it comes to recreation, we actually have a nonprofit organization called North Maine Woods, which is accessible online, and you guys can learn about it. But it's another interesting thing that people don't think about all the time is that forestry and our forest practices actually opens up all of this forest land to the public. So we have thousands and thousands of miles of woods roads that we allow the public for a small fee to go out on this land. And so people understand that small fee is just basically to manage the users themselves, you know, to keep track of who's going in and out and make sure that we know what's going on out there. So that is one of the great benefits of forestry in the state. And the culture of us Mainers is that we've always enjoyed all this forest land, kind of like it's our own, but they're really our private landowners that own it.
All right.
And the only other thing I'd add to that is we do have a lot of recreation on our land, whether it's us or Seven Islands or whatnot. You take one of the big events up here in the wintertime, it's the Can-Am 250. So you get dog sledders running through the woods in North Maine Woods, you know, enjoying themselves. Or if it's in the summertime, you get ATVs and stuff like that outside the North Maine Woods, because North Maine Woods is there to, there's a safety component there as well. So they manage what goes on there, but at the same time, you got families that have been hunting and fishing and all these things in the North Maine Woods.
Right, and we have a national scenic river. You know, the Allegash Waterway runs right through the heart of some of the ownership that I help manage, and we work hand in hand with those resource managers to make sure that forestry and recreation can coexist. And you know, so I guess I would say that we do a lot to help facilitate recreation up here in this area. I know that maybe it's a little bit different in some other areas in the state, but I'm proud to be part of one of the companies that's probably at the forefront of those things.
Cliff, thanks for your call. We're going to go to Douglas calling from Portland. Hi, Douglas. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi there. I was just curious to know how UAS technologies, or if UAS technologies, are being utilized in Maine in the forestry division.
When you say UAS, I think you mean drones. You guys using drones, Jeff?
Drones are becoming a very, very important part of what we're doing. UMFK now has a drone. I know Orno's using them. A lot of companies are starting to move that direction, but it's one of those fields that's rapidly growing. We're not even knowing exactly how we're going to be able to use them because it's evolving all the time, but you know, it's a cheap way to get digital imagery of our forests. We can get it quickly. We don't have to wait for a flight or do it on an annual or biannual basis. We can do it whenever we need to do it. We can collect different types of data from drones. We can collect just simple digital imagery. We can use. We can get LiDAR data from it. We can get real-time data from it. So the opportunities for it are fantastic. It's going to really there's going to be a lot of cost savings to it long term. For instance, you can go out and do quick regeneration surveys or vegetation surveys that before you'd have to put somebody on the ground and you could only do a sample, whereas now we can look at an entire area very quickly and get a very accurate estimation of what's growing there, what's not growing there, or what type of competition do we have, or you know, are there insects and diseases in a given area. So yeah, UAVs are becoming extremely important into the industry, just like they are in agriculture as well.
All right, Douglas, good question, and thank you. I'm going to try to squeeze in a couple more questions. I'm going to go to Henry in Otisfield. Hi, Henry. Go ahead.
Hello. I'm calling you from my 36-acre woodlot, which used to belong to Dr. Decky Nutting, a name I'm sure folks there recognize. when I started clearing this land, or not clearing it, thinning it, I favored beech because of its wildlife value. Then I had beech bark disease move in, and I read an article in Schwalm that says you shouldn't cut such a tree down because it will push up hundreds of new trees, all of which are diseased, that you should poison this tree. So I started poisoning these trees before I cut them down for firewood. And then I had a forester visit me, a retired forester, who told me that beached bark disease would not kill these trees, just make them ugly. Yet one of your panelists today indicated that it is fatal to beech trees. So I'm confused.
Okay, and you guys have 2 minutes.
Beech bark disease is definitely fatal to the tree. It might not happen right away, but over a several-year period, a mature beech tree will be killed by the beech bark. And as we discussed earlier, you're going to get hundreds of sprouts back from every beech tree that dies. And those trees will do just fine for several years. And then when they get around maybe 20 years old or so, you'll start seeing the canker moving into those trees. And they will die within a few years. And then the cycle just continues and continues.
So what should Henry do?
Well, there is one thing that's pretty interesting is that there are some beech trees that are resistant to this beech bark disease. So if you happen to have some of those in your woodlot that you notice are not carrying that problem, I would make sure to keep those beech trees because you could propagate a line of beech on your woodlot that would be resistant to this problem.
All right. Well, good luck to you, Henry. I'm going to read an email here from Mary Ella. Maine Forest Service provides a list of licensed consulting foresters. Foresters can prepare a forest management plan and advise landowners in setting their goals. Landowners' goals can include improving their wildlife habit as well as providing income through harvest management. So that's great information, Mariella. I'm sure a lot of people listening today would like to know about that. And that is going to be our last comment for this hour. I want to thank everybody here in the audience for joining us for this special broadcast from University of Maine and Presque Isle. And thank you to our guest, Doug Sear, Human Resource Manager for Irving Woodlands LLC and Irving Forest Products Incorporated. Jeff Dubas, Instructor of Forestry at the University of Maine, Fort Kent. Ryan Wishart, Operations Manager for the Seven Islands Land Company. And thank you to our hosts here at the University of Maine, Presque Isle. John Keimel ran the board today. We had additional help from John Bradford and Nick Godfrey here at UMPE. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our archives at mainecalling.org. Today's broadcast will be broadcast again at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. And tomorrow on the program, we're back here at UMaine Presque Isle. Our topic will be the role of potatoes in Maine. If you're in the area, come by and check out the show. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.
Special thanks to our Maine Calling On the Road Aroostook sponsors, CEI, Cary Medical Center, and MMG Insurance.